The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary. And our phones are open, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. At the microphone, Dr. Rick Mars, taking your questions and comments today on Ask the Pastor. Dr. Rick Mars from Concordia Seminary. Good morning.
Good morning. Very good to be with you again, Paul.
And you're open to any topics here today?
I'm open to topics that I know something about anyway.
I got to tell you, the biggest complaint I hear out on the streets is how dark it is so early in the afternoon.
Yeah.
That really does affect people.
Yeah. There's the whole type of depression, seasonal depression that can come on to various people. Seasonal affective disorder, they call it.
And I guess we have to change gears physiologically or something this time of year, because it does get dark so soon, and it kind of throws our clock off, doesn't it?
Yeah. Again, different people seem to be more affected by it than others, but, you know, I used to notice, especially when I lived in Chicago, that I had to kind of make sure I got outside for a few minutes each day in January, especially, because I would start to feel just a little bit more down than I normally do, and think I'd maybe just have a slight touch of that seasonal affective sort of thing. Not enough melanin that gets activated in our skin cells for some reason. How we are fearfully and wonderfully made, but some people are greatly affected by it and actually need to get some other.
You got to find an oasis, so. And maybe it's at the Y or someplace like that.
Right.
When I was living in Columbia, Missouri, back in the early 70s. They had on campus what they called the barn. This is the old practice building for the Missouri Tigers basketball team. And I had an eighth of a mile dirt track around the outside of it. So I'd go in there and run 32 laps. And they had lots of windows.
Yeah.
So it gave you kind of the feeling it was spring and you were running outside.
Yep.
You know, and that made a big difference. That was my oasis back then. That was a nice thing to have. So I guess we should find that oasis. I think we've got a question already. We got a phone call coming in. The receptionist stepped out of the area for a while. You're on the air with Dr. Rick Mars. Did you have a question?
Yes, this is Phil.
Yes, Phil.
A friend of mine and I, we were talking, and he was wondering if you're a teacher and you're a trained teacher, or even a minister in a different kind of, instead of the Missouri Synod Lutheran, you know, there's other denominations, and you let people know that you're available either to be a teacher or a pastor, and you get your word out there that, you know, you're available to do these things. He was saying that maybe if you do that, instead of wait for people to come to you and ask you, then you might be like marketing yourself like the world would do, and it's not really God then. And how would you know if God is involved in it if you market yourself? So that was kind of our question, and we was going back and forth. You know, what does the Bible say about that? What is your opinion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, different denominations do it in different ways. We just were talking at our seminary, students do get calls in the spring of each year to go out. So particular congregations are looking for pastors, and so they don't market themselves. In fact, in our denomination, we do kind of wince at that sort of thinking, because we do think it undermines the legitimacy of the call. But there are other denominations that that's not the case. Covenant Seminary, who we very highly appreciate here at Concordia, their students are kind of expected to go out and do some job interviews and send resumes and things like that in order to find either a teaching or preaching position. So I don't think it's like a sin one way or the other, but because of the what we think of as the importance of the call, and really wanting to emphasize that it is something from God through congregations, our synod has opted to do it that way rather than the more American job hunt sort of process.
Well, can I jump in with a question?
Sure.
Phil and Dr. Rick Mars, is there a godly way of a biblical way of marketing yourself? Is there some in-between place? Does God market through us?
Well, I think, you know, every time somebody is out preaching and teaching in public, or if, you know, some of their information gets out onto the web, there's nothing wrong with somebody having a website for themselves to kind of post their own Christian beliefs, and if somebody sees that and thinks that they like the way that they teach, there's nothing, you know, inherently wrong with that. But you know, in our circles, we tend to prefer to let it kind of bubble up from the bottom and let the congregations be the primary source of that information. But who are congregations? But members, and members then learn about individuals, and so they put those individuals, pastors or teachers, on call lists. And so there is, you know, some degree of, you know, marketing going on. We don't just hide our teaching and preaching in a under a barrel somewhere. I don't know a lot of the history of the early church, but I think in the early church they were more localized. They had, you know, probably a pastor and then a set of teaching deacons, and then when that pastor died, they chose whichever was the most gifted of those teaching deacons to come on and become their pastor. They probably didn't have as much movement between congregations as we do in our modern culture, but that's because we have modern communications and have developed these other processes. So, you know, it just gets down probably to, you know, if we are, in a sense, so bent on making our will and placing our will upon some particular congregation. I mean, you hear the horror stories. There's even that old movie called The Apostle that's about a modern Pentecostal preacher that just goes out and tells this group of people, you know, I'm your preacher, and there are those that have kind of implanted themselves into a group of people and said, God has called me and therefore you should listen to me. We have greater fears about, you know, the outcomes of those situations when somebody does, you know, claim that they've received a call from God and therefore these people should listen to them, rather than God calling, kind of bubbling up from the congregation and going to them.
And then I guess whether or not you accept that call is plays into that too, doesn't it?
Right. Right. Yeah.
Because if you continue to make yourself available for other calls,
mm-hmm.
you're kind of guiding this yourself, aren't you?
Well, and you know, a pastor or a teacher, once they are in a call position, then if they receive another call, they actually have two calls at that time. So the call in place that they currently are in, and the call that is coming to them that is new, and so that can be a very gut-wrenching decision. It was a gut-wrenching decision for me to come and teach at the seminary. I told my students the last couple of days that 4 years ago in the summer, I cried 5 times publicly because I didn't want to leave my congregation, but I did feel called to come and teach here at the seminary as well, and knew that there were very few pastors that had my doctoral PhD counseling sort of background. So,
Phil, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, you did use a word, I feel, and that was another thing that we was talking about. He said, how do you know when it's God or just your feelings?
Yeah.
Now, you know, we want to make sure, but sometimes there's nothing in the Bible except for, you know, make sure that your call and election is sure. I mean, I think there's a passage, something like that, but and that's what he was just concerned about, making sure that you was doing God's will and that you should be a teacher or a preacher, that was exactly your calling. And you know, he thought the less that you got involved, the more that God can, you know, confirm that for you.
Right, and that's probably why we, partly it'd be difficult for me to go through the polity of how our particular synod denomination came to have the structure that it does. You don't want to hear me drone on for 20 minutes now about the history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and C.F.W. Walther and those sorts of things. But, you know, we had an option early on to become more of an Episcopal sort of design where the bishops were the ones that said, you know, okay, you go here, you go there, you know, and they were the ones that chose things for the congregations. We didn't think that was, Walther and others didn't think that was the right sort of thing to have for congregations here in the United States that were more independent-minded with more independent people who wanted to vote for things on their own. And so since we don't have bishops per se in our denomination, but we have presidents and vice presidents of synod and districts and that sort of thing, so we did choose to go that direction. As for the feelings end of your question, boy, that's always a complicated one, and you know, different people make their decisions based upon what they think is logic, rationale. They may write down a list of the pros and cons on a piece of paper saying, you know, here are the pros for staying here, here are the cons for staying here, here are the pros and cons for leaving. Weigh all that out. I actually encourage people to do that, because even if they make an emotional decision, at least if that emotional decision is kind of all laid out there on paper and they see the factors and the logic underlying their decision, even if they start to make a decision, they say, oh, that just doesn't feel like the right decision, well, then maybe all right to go with that feeling after much prayer and consideration and talking to others that they respect. I always encourage pastors to, you know, talk to at least two or three other pastors about what this call might be like, and whether they think it would be a good match for them or not. I did that when I took this call to the seminary.
Well, Phil's friend who has a concern, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Won't that help guide Phil's friend?
I think so. I think very much.
Just expressing a concern is a good starting place.
Yeah, I'm glad, because, again, there are just some people out there that go into ministry for self-serving practices. In fact, there's a scale on the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, called the Psychopathic Deviant Scale. And it just indicates that there's, you know, kind of some problems with this person. And you would imagine that criminals score high on the scale, but also
highly manipulative people.
Highly manipulative people. And again, not that everybody who, you know, is a certain occupation scores high on this scale, but the occupations that score the highest on that scale are, after criminals, policemen, lawyers, and politicians, and fifth on the scale is pastors.
Hmm.
So as a group of people who go into this particular vocation, again, not that all pastors score high on this PD scale, the psychopathic deviant scale, but enough of them do that they're actually going into it because of the power, of the influence that they will have, they're not going into it for the right Christ reasons, for the service reasons. And again, that may be all mixed up in one particular person. He may have, you know, a lot of himself is focused on service, but there's just this other aspect to his personality that, boy, really likes to be up in that pulpit and having several hundred people watch him every Sunday and shaking his hand and telling him what a great job he did. There's just a certain narcissism that can come up among us. And we have to watch out for that, because, again, it is tempting. I could tell you, too, I'm not sure if radio announcers score high on that scale, but there are other scales that they score high on.
In fact, when I was a little kid and I wanted to be a priest, it was for all those wrong reasons. Yeah. Phil, thanks for the call. Yeah. Thanks for starting the conversation here.
Phil.
All right, thank you.
Now, on a seminary campus like this, you see a wide variety of personalities, men that are going to become pastors.
True.
And you know what their strengths and weaknesses are, perhaps. And maybe some of your colleagues do.
We do some testing and stuff of students. And
do you?
Not every faculty member has access to all of that testing, and I don't want access to it myself, but we end up learning about our students.
Well, I'm wondering about a congregation. How can a congregation judge candidates' strengths and weaknesses based on a couple of interviews?
Well, they also get what's called a set form, and the students fill that out, and there's information that goes to the district presidents so that they know what the strengths and weaknesses. They actually do have access to a lot of this testing information and such. And so if congregations are calling a pastor directly from the seminary, the district president usually has the bishop, so to speak, although we don't call him that. The district president does have a considerable amount of influence as to whether he thinks that pastor is a good match for that congregation or not, and they can pretty much veto the match if they don't think it is a good one.
Ah, that's good to have that kind of guidance.
Right.
Let's go back to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jan's on the line with us from Atlanta. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Pastor.
Hi there.
I was just thinking that, your conversation made me think of two places, Acts 1, verses 21 and following, with respect to the process of calling a pastor. And the second is where Paul kind of delineates his credentials. I think it's in Colossians after he had that, you know, traumatic or dramatic conversion. He didn't just jump into the ministry. He spent like, what, 10, 13 years?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I really want your thoughts on the Acts 21:21 passage, Acts first chapter, 21st verse, because sometimes I think we can get ahead of God in, you know, identifying what we think we need when what our goal is to just let the Spirit reveal who would be best in that capacity.
Mm-hmm. I really like that you put out the Acts 1:21 because I make an emphasis of that in classes sometimes. And ironically, just before I became the vicar at the church that I became the pastor at, then a year later, the pastor who was preaching a day that I happened to be visiting was preaching on this text, and it just had a big impact on me that, you know, this Matthias who was chosen, and he and I forgot who the other one, Barsabbas, Joseph called Barsabbas, were not chosen because they were the most gifted men who were left following Jesus. They were the ones who had been with us as witness to his resurrection, had been from the very beginning, from the baptism of John until the day when he was taken up from us. They had just been hanging around. I mean, literally, they'd heard all the teachings of Jesus, and so the other apostles knew they wanted an apostle who had all those same experiences that they do, even if he wasn't one that was chosen by God at that time. Now, there's a little bit of an argument that maybe Paul was the one who, you know, God eventually chose to replace
Judas,
yes. And this was an interesting way that they went about it, and then they cast lots for him. You know, we don't usually encourage people to do that necessarily either, but it's not a faithless thing to do.
Well, remember, in the Old Testament, the Urim and the Thummim, so whatever, I mean, and then David on regular occasions asked God, okay, this enemy is coming in, this enemy is surrounding me, how should I deal with that? And he was open to whatever his discernment showed him God's answer was.
Mm-hmm.
I think we get too caught up in ourselves where we think, unlike Jesus saying to us, you did not choose me, but I chose you. And finally, when Jesus prayed his high priestly prayer, he said, I don't pray for these only. I pray for those who will believe on me based on their words.
Mm-hmm.
So we are ultimately a priesthood of believers, but we have a specific function, and we don't need to burden our pastors with what we need to address. Okay?
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Jan. Mm-hmm. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go and talk to Dave here. Dave, you're on Ask the Pastor with Dr. Rick Mars.
Yes, I was intrigued by the first question that came in, and something else that came to mind. I was going to ask, I happen to know the pastor at the SEM was involved in placement of graduates or of the SEM and such. And I had received in the mail, I think a newer organization under the Lutheran Church of Missouri said having to do with Soldiers of the Cross. It helps pastors and teachers who are down, who have a particular hardship case or something. And it also mentioned in there something that surprised me. I think it mentioned in there, in the letter that they sent out, there were about four or five of the graduates of the SEM this year that didn't have calls. and they were kind of stuck because they couldn't do anything else for income while they were waiting to get a call. And so this Soldiers of the Cross kind of helped them get through some time there. I guess the thing that bothered me a little bit is maybe enlighten me a little bit or so. If you can, maybe you don't know how that works, that if a person is a graduate of the SAM and doesn't have a call, that's where they start having money to come in to pay for living and such, and also to start paying off their bills to the SAM and such. And they're, I guess, prohibited in some ways from doing anything but the pastor, but then they can't do anything to get a call. So I guess I was just a little disturbed by that. And if you can throw a little bit of light on how that works, and if a seminary grad doesn't get a call, what they're in for.
Yeah. Now, again, the good news, at least for us, all of our graduates here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis did get calls. Some of them didn't have calls in April when we had call day, but they did all then receive calls by June or July to various places. There may have been some at another seminary that didn't. I'm not sure on that detail.
Okay, didn't say how long, but did they get calls finally? Some of them, except for one, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. It is a circumstance where it is not a seamless process, because unfortunately, you know, we at the seminary don't have control over it. It actually is congregations that are coming to their district, and they don't come to us directly at the seminary. They come to their district presidents, and then their district presidents decide if they think that this is a good congregation to take a recent graduate. And if the DP thinks, no, this isn't a good situation, I think they should try to call another pastor from the field who has more experience, then the DP has that sort of influence. But again, the DPs are very interested in getting our graduates out into the churches, because they know that this is the future of the church. Each new year, each new generation of pastors coming on in 10 or 20 years will be the leaders of the denomination. So, it is a concern because of the financial situations of more and more churches. There have been fewer calls that have been coming. Sometimes it's just a matter of economics. Sometimes the DPs see something in a candidate that they think, I'm not sure I want that person in my district as a pastor. And so if that happens to enough graduates, then there may be, you know, a 5 or 10 DPs would be willing to have that person in their that man in their district, and another 20 that don't. And if those 5 or 10 just don't happen to have congregations that fit for him at that time, then he does have to wait, and that's unfortunately part of the call process. We all find vocations in life, hopefully more than just passing out fast food someplace, but trying to find some way to use the gifts that God has given to us. So,
thanks for the question.
Thanks, Dave.
Do some students, when they receive a call, go through any kind of postpartum depression, because perhaps they just love the academic life and studying theology, and they're maybe not prepared to practice out there?
Some, although many of those can stay on for another year and take another master's degree.
Oh, really?
If you guys do stay on and after 4 years and say, you know, I want to learn more, and I don't think I'm quite ready yet at age 24 or 25 or 26, so they can stay on and get a master's in sacred theology, or they can go do graduate work at some mm-hmm. other institution someplace else. They don't have to take a call right when they finish their master of divinity. But the vast majority of them are open to taking a call. They want to get out there. They want to be serving Christ in these churches. That's what they came and studied.
Is there a social worker aspect to being a pastor?
There is, although it's one of the big emphases we try to make, is that there's a distinction between social work and pastorate work. Again, I teach pastoral counseling, so I'm really emphasizing that it's important for them to be soul carers, soul curers, and that's a job that nobody else can do like a pastor can. Even a social worker who's a Christian doesn't go at that the same way that a pastor can, because a pastor can bring them the Lord's Supper and baptize them if they haven't been baptized, all of those sorts of things. Bring the sacraments as well as the word.
Mm-hmm. I think that would appeal to me and my personality, the grassroots service.
Yeah.
One-on-one, that
very,
kind of thing.
Very, very important.
Let's continue on here with the second half of Ask the Pastor after the break. Our phones remain open, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
I'm Dale Meyer. Because of generous donors like you, Concordia Seminary has been able to retire its debt. We thank our gracious Lord for that, and we sincerely thank you. With debt behind us, we are looking forward to updating our campus and to lower the cost of seminary education for our future students. Because of partners like you, Concordia Seminary has a positive future. Thank you.
Tower Grove House, the Victorian country home of Missouri Botanical Garden founder Henry Shaw, is decorated with wreaths, garlands, floral centerpieces, greenery, and a holiday tree for the season. You can stroll through the historic home from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesdays through Saturdays, and from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sundays. It's closed on Mondays. Children can enjoy storytelling on Saturdays at 11 a.m., and there's a special Seek and Find activity. The Victorian Christmas at Tower Grove House runs now through January 2nd.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
It really makes a difference who you vote for. Take Rhode Island, for example. Lincoln Chafee won his race for governor. The governor-elect put together a transition team with an admitted illegal abortionist on it. Pablo Rodriguez, a prominent abortionist in the state, has admitted doing illegal abortions in an undisclosed South American country where babies are protected by law. He also trained lay midwives to do abortions in his absence. This abortionist believes access to abortion is a blessing from God. I happen to be reading Leviticus, where God said, whoever sacrifices their children to Moloch must be put to death. It's pretty clear killing children isn't a blessing. For the next 4 years, Governor Chafee will pursue a vigorous abortion agenda. It really makes a difference who you vote for.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Reason for the season. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. Motorists entering New York City via the Lincoln Tunnel are getting caught up in the modern war over Christmas. On the way in, they're confronted by a billboard set up by American atheists that says, you know it's a myth, this season celebrate reason. The Catholic League countered with a billboard on the other side bearing the message, you know it's real, this season celebrate Jesus. American Atheists President David Silverman says he doesn't mind that when drivers pass through the tunnel, Catholics get the last word.
Because my word is correct, and they're going to think about my word while they're going through the tunnel, and hopefully by the time they get to the other side and they see this season celebrate Jesus, they'll realize how exclusionary it is.
The Catholic League's Jeff Field says atheists are missing the reason for the season.
Jesus was born and was a historical figure, and Christians believe him to be the Son of God, and that's what this season's about.
He adds that the symbolic message is there's light at the end of the tunnel. I'm Steve Coleman.
Serving with heart, that's Lutheran Senior Services. As one of the largest not-for-profit senior housing networks in the nation, Lutheran Senior Services lives out its mission every day through independent living, assisted living, skilled nursing, affordable housing, in-home services, and hospice care. Building on a legacy of more than 150 years, Lutheran Senior Services helps older adults live life to the fullest. Learn more at lssliving.org.
60 minutes a week can completely revolutionize your finances, says financial expert Ellie Kay, who paid back $40,000 in debt. Now a TV network and Fortune 500 company consultant, she's written 14 books on money. Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace. Ellie wants you out of debt to stay out of debt. Her financial workout proves all things money-related can change. Next time, Woman to Woman.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on KFUO Radio.
It's Ask the Pastor on the Bible Study, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you seminary professors offer any advice to the students going out into the worker field about social media and the blogs that are so prevalent today, and not to get too wrapped up in that kind of stuff? Because they can waste a lot of time up there.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably we make some passing comments in classes, or there's nothing systematic in the curriculum that I can remember about that. But it is a concern that you can get so caught up in blogging that you forget that you need to have face-to-face contact with your parishioners. Mm-hmm. And one of our faculty members, Jeff Gibbs, says something, I'm probably not going to quote him directly, but you know, we should make some sort of rule that everybody has to make at least three pastoral visits and two evangelism calls before they write a blog. You know, if we were actually more out there visiting people face-to-face that are in our locale and less interconnected on the social media. Again, the social media has its place, and we can be thankful that it can interconnect us with other Christians. And what I'm really pleased is our graduates talk about, you know, staying in more Facebook connection with each other than I think happened 10 or 15, 50 years ago, obviously. They can stay connected and ask each other how things going in your
mentor each other and
mentor
that kind
yeah
of thing.
Yeah support yeah. each other.
Oh, what I notice when I take a look at some of the Christian blogs, Lutheran blogs, is it's largely dominated by some of the same people all the time.
Right.
That must spend a good deal of time overnight expressing their thoughts, entering into debate, and that kind of thing. And that leads me into another. You know, something else that's going on today, when we have these sparring matches, it seems like there's polarization that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever is polarized away is equally offset by someone who's affirmed
right.
by that polarization. And this demonizing enters into some of this debate, demonizing your opposition.
Right.
And that seems to be a new phenomenon that's become a part of the digital age.
Right. And, you know, it is, you know, people text and send messages because it's emotionally safer to send the text than it is to see somebody face to face. I mean, I hear these reports of young people breaking up with each other over texts because they don't want to do it face to face. The same thing, I think, happens. You know, would you write or would you say the same thing if you were sending it, if you were talking to a person on the other side, and you can actually see their face and their reaction? Would you say that same thing in writing on a blog? But a blog is sort of a safer way of doing it because you can't see their faces, you can't see their emotional reaction, you can't see the pain that might be causing. You can't have the immediate sort of feedback, although, again, some of them do get into pretty immediate feedback debates right within their blog, and then the rest of us might read it a week later or 6 months later. Sometimes I've come across things that somebody wrote like 3 years later, and I laugh because it was funny at that time, and I didn't get to it until 3 years later. So.
Well, here's a mental health question for you. How do you know when something that was a hobby is becoming an obsession?
If it starts to detract from other areas of your life, if it's affecting relationships that you have with family, if it's starting to affect how you eat, how you drink, how you, you know, just have everyday needs, if it's affecting the reaction to your congregation, and I think a lot of the pastors who maybe get overly involved on these websites need to look at, you know, how are things going in terms of my attendance and how many home visits I'm making? Am I spending so much time on the blog and even on my own church's website that it's leading to people feeling distant from me?
There's a disconnect.
A disconnect, yeah, emotional disconnect. Because, again, it's a lot of what our Christian faith is about is that personal face-to-face interaction with others, not convincing them through some sort of logical argument into the kingdom. Had Kirk Clayton on a week or so ago, and he said something like argumentation can only kind of make you get from, you know, Kansas down to the beach, but only the Spirit can actually bring you into the water, so to speak, can actually
the
bring
Spirit,
you into faith.
We were talking about that this morning with Dr. Fred Bowery about how it's the Holy Spirit who closes the deal.
Exactly. Right, right. He uses us weak human beings to start the deal, and it's amazing to me that he does, but that's what Jesus arranged.
Yeah, he's the closer.
Yep.
Charles is on the line with us with an Old Testament question. Hi, Charles.
Yeah, hello, Paul, and Professor, do you permit me to change the subject?
Absolutely.
All right, I appreciate it. I must admit to calling this question in many months ago, but I thought I'd ask for a different viewpoint from Professor. In the Genesis chapter 7, it says when God has given instructions to Moses for the ark, of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and the female, and the beasts that are not clean by two. In other words, the unclean and the clean beast of the field. There is no previous categorization of animals as clean or unclean prior to this. A lot of it in Leviticus.
Right.
And then, of course, God takes away that unclean, clean factor when Peter had that vision.
Vision in Acts, yeah.
In Acts 10, the voice came to him a second time, do not call anything impure that God has made clean. I guess my question is it in your opinion, Professor, that the unclean status came from the fall? Because, you know, when God says he created in Genesis 1, every day he said it was good, 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 and then eventually he said very good. It implies a perfect creation, which it occurs, of course was. And so I'm wondering if the unclean factor of animals was part of that initial creation, or do you think it was because of the fall?
Very good question, and it's one that I'll give you an answer for, although I would say, you know, may want to have one of the Old Testament exegetes on sometime and
okay, I'll
have
that.
Charles ask that question of those guys who are going to know that in even more detail than I will. I'm not sure that you could say it was about the fall. It may just be, you know, seven pairs of clean animals having to do with eating, that they wanted to make sure that there were enough of those that could be edible after the flood and such, so they'd have a faster start on that.
But it also says some of them were used for a sacrifice, too.
True.
One of the purposes. Yeah.
Right, right. And, yeah, there were particular sorts of animals that God called for sacrifice. I'm not sure it would be because, I don't think it would be because those animals were somehow more sinless than the other forms of animals, but just God in his wisdom chooses those things. He makes certain things holy, which holy doesn't just mean kind of perfect and sinless, it also means set apart. And so God's people in Israel, and Noah as well, were holy and set apart with distinction to be different from the rest of the community. I went down to the Creation Museum last summer with my wife, and it was interesting there because they promoted the idea that perhaps Noah and his three sons didn't do all of the construction work on the ark themselves, that would have been too much for four men to do, but they actually did hire others to come in, and they were the kind of the engineers and the architects for it. But then they had, you know, scores of other men who were helping them build this huge thing, and then they were witnessing to their faith in Yahweh all along the way, trying to convince these workers to come on board with them, but even in that case, all the workers thought that they were crazy.
Provide them some sweat equity and maybe they'll join in.
Again, we don't have any direct biblical evidence that that's true, although Noah is called a prophet, and prophets do prophesy to groups
point.
Of people, so it is probable that there were many people around coming to see what... I mean, can you imagine if somebody did build something that large out in the middle of Missouri somewhere, there would be gawkers come to just look at it, and that would give the builder an opportunity to say, well, this is the reason why I'm building this big building or this strange boat or whatever. And so surely people did come and see it over those many decades that they were building.
A lot of scoffers because it never had rained up until that time, so I guess there'd be a lot of interest and intrigue and scoffing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, but, yeah, for the animals...
Well, I don't suspect that the designation unclean has to refer to anything that's not perfect in God's original creation. It's just probably
right.
A semantic thing. But, okay, I'll appreciate the answer.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for the call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, you pointed out that you saw an article on ChristianPost.com based on a new survey, and depression and negative emotions are apparently less common among very religious Americans than among the non-religious, according to this poll. There, I brought it up on the board for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Gallup's new report Tuesday shows that 15.6% of American adults who say religion is an important part of daily life and who attend a church, synagogue, or mosque at least every week or almost every week have been diagnosed with depression in their lifetime. 15.6. Meanwhile, 18.7 non-religious Americans have been diagnosed. Among moderately religious adults, 20.4% reported having been diagnosed with depression.
Mm-hmm.
Gallup noted in its report that the finding does not necessarily imply that the act of becoming religious will improve things for you. I have to look at my copy. My browser's not cooperating.
No.
Still, the research group documents a significant relationship between high religiosity and lower levels of negative emotional well-being. Well, doctor, what do you make of that?
Yeah. When I was in graduate school 30 years ago, I remember being forced to read a number of studies by secular psychologists that actually made claims like religion was detrimental to your mental health, that it was actually something that promoted mental disorders. And I can remember reading that and then going to research classes and saying, we have to do everything by research, and then wondering, well, what's the research behind what this very often prominent psychologist, I remember one of the articles specifically was a former president of the American Psychological Association, wrote that religion was a mental was close to being a mental disorder, and I just didn't, obviously I was a Christian at that time and didn't believe what they were saying, and had my other evidence to point to, but there wasn't a lot of research done one way or the other. Then in the 1990s, a variety of people did start doing research on spiritual factors and Christian factors in mental health and physical health. Actually, one I found, David Larson in 1993 did a series of studies where they found out that men who attended church at least weekly and who rated religion as being highly important to them had significantly lower blood pressure than men who rarely attended church and who said religion was personally unimportant. So if religiosity can have that kind of effect on your blood pressure, then it seems to be a positive thing as well. Now, again, I do want to note, it does not mean, this is not a theology of glory in which we say, okay, if you become more religious, all of your problems are going to go away. It was a case where there were only small differences. 15.6% of American adults who were religious were diagnosed with depression, whereas non-religious or less religious were 19, 20%. So it's only like a 5% difference between those two groups. So that's small, but still a significant difference between
But doesn't the Bible suggest that if you're in the Word, you'll receive the peace that passes all understanding?
Yes, Philippians 4, and is the peace that surpasses all understanding. That does not mean that all of our problems will go away.
Right.
And so Christians still have children that get sick and sometimes die. Christians still have disorders of their body that lead them to have dementia or depression. There are a whole host of things that happen in the fall to us physiologically. There are a whole host of, you know, physical diseases that Christians get just like non-Christians get. And if we have a serious disease or a serious, you know, a family member gets killed in a car accident, that can lead to, obviously, sadness and even depression.
Wouldn't there be more comfort in life associated, and contentment perhaps, associated with an eternal rather than a temporal perspective?
Yeah.
And could that be a common sense reason for this?
I think that's kind of what's happening here is, you know, you are going to have negative emotions that come up in everybody because bad things happen to us all, both at an internal level in our brain physiology, but an external level in those bad things that can happen to us. But Christians do have a different hope. I mean, 1 Thessalonians 4, Paul writes about we grieve, but we do not grieve as those who have no hope. You know, we have a realization that Christ is in control, and that even though our loved one may have died of cancer or was killed in a car accident, or we're dying of cancer or seriously injured in some way, that we know who is still in charge, and that knowledge can give us the peace that surpasses all understanding. But still, even if we have that peace that surpasses all understanding, doesn't mean that we're happy-go-lucky and feeling like we could skip around, you know, a mile away all the time. So,
I'm going to share something personal, a real slice of life kind of thing, and I just heard this yesterday. My mother's in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and my wife's become her best friend caregiver.
Right.
I work a lot, and I'm not around as much as she is, and my mom really depends on Jeannie, leans on her heavily. And she says, this is just so strange when you can't remember how to run the washing machine. Hmm. And she says, sometimes I wake up and I just look at the ceiling and I realize what's happening to me. And I say to myself, it's because I've been a bad person.
No.
Now, how do you respond to something like that? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to need to respond to that.
Right. You keep going back with the gospel. Every one of us needs to hear direct gospel messages every day of our lives, and somebody with Alzheimer's needs to hear it even more often than that. To remind it that they are a baptized child of God, baptized into Christ's death and resurrection, Romans 6, that God sent Jesus for the whole world, John 3:16. And we are saved by grace through faith alone, Ephesians 2:8-9, all of those sorts of messages we need to hear every day, every hour. And again, especially somebody with Alzheimer's. In fact, I just told a class this morning that people with severe Alzheimer's farther on down the line where they can't even remember their sons or daughters' names and such. Mm-hmm. Very often those sons and daughters tell their pastors, well, you know, don't bother going and visiting mom, you know, because she doesn't remember who you are, she doesn't remember who we are, you know, and don't need to waste your time. But I sometimes would take those sons and daughters with me to visit their parent, and they would be shocked when I would start to say the Lord's Prayer with their mom or dad. And the mom and dad would repeat the Lord's Prayer.
Respond to that.
Respond, or John 3:16, or the Apostles' Creed.
You'll see them respond to hymns.
Yeah,
during
hymns,
a little chapel service.
Right, right. All of those things seem to be more deeply embedded within our brains and psyches and spirits than even our close family relationships. And that's, I think, a Holy Spirit thing going on there.
Yeah, we don't know what they know.
Right,
There's no way to assume that.
Yeah.
Brad's been holding patiently. Brad, you've got a question about mental health training for seminarians. That's a good question. You want to develop that for us? Go ahead, Brad.
You've discussed a lot about mental health issues, depression, et cetera. How much training does a seminarian have when he graduates and leaves the seminary and is called to a congregation to counsel his flock?
Yeah. Easy.
I'll listen off the phone.
Oh, that's okay. The easy answer is not enough. I joke with students when they have one required course in our seminary, pastor as counselor. And then we offer a variety of elective courses and encourage them to get continuing education training in premarital counseling and things like that. But there is one required course that they have, and I tell them, you know, I used to be the director of a master's degree program in counseling up at Concordia, Chicago, and there we had 2 years to help form the next generation of master's level counselors. And so I say, I can't cram everything into 10 weeks in one class that we expected people to know in that into a seminary course, but we try to get as much into it as we can, and we don't expect pastors to be master's level counselors or PhD level counselors, but we do want them to be the German word is Seelsorgers, soul healers. That's a word that's been around before German, even. Cura animarum was the Latin term for it. Pastors and other church workers, deaconesses and such, have been soul healers throughout the history of the Christian church. And they didn't know a lot about what we know today about mental health issues, like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia and things like that, but they still brought the Word of God to people for that healing, for that soul cure. And so now then today we have the added benefit of knowing we can bring God's word to somebody who's struggling with mental health issues, struggling with counseling issues and relationship issues. Plus we can also hopefully learn some things from the field of psychology about how relationships work and what we call first article issues in our seminary speak, because they have to do with the created order of things in the first article of the creed. And so, again, the answer to Brad's question is not enough, but we feel confident that at least the men that are graduating have a heart for that. I've watched them for those 10 weeks, and we put them through a variety of other experiences. They actually have to go for 5 sessions of counseling themselves to see what it feels like from the receiving end, so they have a better empathic and sort of experience with doing it themselves in the future.
Would you like to see more continuing ed classes for pastors along those lines?
Yeah, I tell people we do a very good job in our denomination with continuing ed in exegetical, systematics, and somewhat in history and in homiletics, but we don't do as much in pastoral care issues. The one exception, I'll promote something from a Fort Wayne former professor, Hal Sinkbeil and Beverly Yonke do doxology all around the country, and so I encourage congregations to encourage their pastor to go get that continuing education, because it is specifically on pastoral care issues, both the pastor taking care of himself and the pastor taking care of his flock. And they approach it. Bev Yonke's a clinical psychologist. Hal Sinkbeil is a very, very experienced lifelong pastor and then seminary professor for, I think, 5 or 10 years toward the end of his ministry. And so now then they have this ministry, which I think is very helpful. Ambassadors of Reconciliation does some of this as well in helping us learn how to be reconciled with one another. Just a variety of people that have started doing various pastoral care things out there, and I'm glad to see that. So.
Beyond the pastor's job of helping people develop that eternal perspective by understanding they are saved by grace through faith, their salvation ducks in order, is it also incumbent upon the pastor to help that parishioner get through the next week?
Yes, but I just said in class again this morning, what pastors do is eternally more important than what medical doctors and psychologists do, because psychologists are really just trying to make you maybe 20 or 30% less depressed or 20 or 30% less anxious in the next week or two, and medical doctors are just trying to keep you alive for another 6 months or a year or 5 or 10 years. Pastors are trying to keep you alive eternally. That is their role, and again, that the other stuff that doctors and medical doctors and psychologists do pales in comparison to the power of the Word of God. I mean, there's a reason why I left the field of psychology as a profession and went into the pastoral ministry, because I knew that there were just things that I couldn't do and say as a counselor that I could do and say as a pastor that are much more life-changing.
Those other things are like Band-Aids.
Yeah.
That's Dr. Rick Mars, and let's take one quick question from James, who also has been holding patiently. James, you're on KFUO Radio.
Yes, I'd like to ask you, Pastor, is there any studies out there that talk about if you have to reach a point of healthy self-actualization before you are able to relate properly to God, or does that hinder a healthy proper relationship to God? And the reason why I ask it is because we have these discussions about the proper or the most efficient way of, to be a Christian. Is it to clean up the fishbowl, or is it just to fish? Are we to work on those things like health care and the poor and those foundational things, and then once people have this foundation, they'll reach a point of actualization where they'll relate properly to God, or are we to fish? I hope that wasn't convoluted. I tried to get it in fast, but do we have to reach a healthy point of self-actualization before we can relate properly to God?
And I think he's saying, is it an either or?
Right. I mean, a great question, James. Yeah, and the whole self-actualization comes out of the field of psychology and the humanistic sort of background with it. And no, I don't think we do, although, again, we do encourage people to have a certain level of spiritual growth throughout their lifetimes. I think that's a biblical thing to do. Very few people reach what the psychologists would call self-actualization. And I know a lot of people that are very troubled with mental disorders that still have a very sincere faith in Jesus Christ, and troubled with physical disorders and such, and have a very sincere faith in Jesus Christ. I could tell you stories on that, but I think we're running out of time.
Oh, you've got perfect timing. You wrap things up nice. It's a pleasure having you here today. Well, Dr. Rick Mars from Concordia Seminary. And tomorrow we'll have another Ask the Pastor session for you here on KFUO Radio. Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.